This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Shohad Kutin, with me, Brian Fernandez. We just come off a nice little weekend there. How was your break, Brian?
Yeah, it was good. A little bit busy over the weekend, but yeah, it was nice. Very nice weather on Saturday, especially.
Yeah, it was. In fact, we've had really topsy-turvy weather. One day it storms, and then the next day it's like bright and sunny, right? So, but that is the way of the world, it seems, right at the moment. It is the 16th of October. We're kind of halfway through the month. And of course, this week we celebrate Deepavali on Wednesday. So we have a midweek break as well.
So what do you have scheduled for Wednesday, Shohad?
Visiting some friends, I guess, or not, or sitting myself in front of a big television.
And watching Netflix.
I would otherwise go back to Singapore. So part of my family's Hindu, but it's such a short little break in the middle of the week. It's difficult to do that. But the Hindu side of my family, because celebrating Deepavali down in Singapore. So all that. Just coming up over the last 12 hours, because we've had quite a bit of news flow. And just to remind you, some of the big news stories that are there globally, a huge bomb in the Somalian capital of Mogadishu on Saturday. Now the death toll has now reached over 200. In fact, the latest count, 239 dead and hundreds of others injured. So around 500 people affected directly by that bomb. So the scourge of terrorism continues.
Unfortunately, yeah, in Somalia, it's just never stopped for decades, hasn't it?
No. Right-wing populism and that story in Europe, we thought it came to an end with the crushing defeat of Marine Le Pen in France. Not necessarily true. Look at the latest numbers coming out of Austria, the Austrian Conservative People's Party, led by a 31-year-old, Sebastian Kurz, is set to win the country's general election, and it's said that he, together with a right-wing party, might form the government.
Well, I think it just looks like Jörg Haider with the younger, better-looking Jörg Haider. In his case, of course, it's about repealing payments to refugees, barring immigrants from receiving benefits till they've lived in Austria for 5 years. So,
yeah, a whole range of kind of anti-immigrant.
Anti-immigration,
yeah,
absolutely.
I don't know if that's enough to run a government, but clearly it's enough to win an election. You said good looking. I think that's the general consensus. I think he looks a bit like a gopher. Now, also in the news, the police are in the United Kingdom investigating assault allegations involving Harvey Weinstein. This is the extension of investigations already happening in the U.S. and this huge fallout from allegations that the man, central to a lot of the dynamics in Hollywood and choosing new talent, has been involved in casting couch culture. Now, it's culture because it's not just one man. It's, in fact, systemic.
Well, you always hear about this over the years. I think this is the first time it's come out in such a big way, and people are just coming out of the woodwork, literally. And now, obviously, he's potentially committed these crimes, not only in the US, but in the UK as well.
Yeah, I think the thing about him is that there have been a lot of secret payouts to people that he's assaulted by his own company. So they're saying that the board of directors, that includes some well-known film stars,
like Ben Affleck,
must have known about what he was up to because they would have had to see, they would have seen it on the accounts, these huge payouts. And so the question of complicity, the question of silence, this is well known, and accepted at some level, that if you're young and up and coming, you're going to have to, accede to the demands of these grotesque older men who control so much power in the system. It's a sad story and one that we'll leave you with. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Victoria by the Kinks. Very successful band from the 70s, 60s, I'm told. That's a quick autocorrect there from our producer, Timothy Kang. Brian Fernandez and myself, Shohad Kutin.
Yeah, you know, Sharad, an interesting article in the BBC, which talks about, poses this question, is there an upside to having no social life? So it talks about this writer, Madeline, who, as a solo entrepreneur, someone working from home, embarked on an experiment to see whether or not having no social life would impact her work productivity. So for a month, she declined all in-person activities with her friends, including going out for drinks, which she always does, coffee, catch-ups, dinners, etc. And the results actually surprised her. One, she initially contended with anxiety because she was missing out by declining social invitations. But, interestingly enough, she felt much more relaxed and satisfied with her decision to stay in on weekends. She was able to concentrate more with pockets of work, and so she was more productive at times which she normally reserved for socialising. She found herself healthier, doing more exercise, going to bed earlier, and also cooking from home. So she experienced a lot less idle moments and allowed herself really to brainstorm and daydream a little bit more. So all in all, she felt just a lot better about herself.
You know, this came out of her experience, Madeline's experience of interviewing highly successful artists, writers, and creative entrepreneurs. She found that one common response to the question of how they could be so prolific and productive was that they said to her that they don't have a social life. And so that, in fact, kind of spurs her to kind of explore this idea of, you know, containing social life and the demands of a social life and seeing if she could then parlay that, all those, you know, extra surplus energies into something else. And I think it'd be true. I know of people who, you know, have written books, and the only thing that seems to come out from them is the time they put aside for that. That, you know, between the demands of work and family and all that, if they could put aside trade-off social life for something else, in this case, it'd be writing a book, they can actually succeed.
Well, the thing is, I think it's all about a balance at the end of the day, especially for people in an inner city environment, who, say someone who lives in London or New York or something like that, and you live in very small, or Hong Kong, closer to home, you live in very small apartments. There is a real need, especially as a single person, to get out of your apartment and so forth. And then when you get out, you can't be aimless. So you set up lots of social engagements, and that tends to be a great time sucker.
I'm wondering about this question that you brought up, the question of balance and what we need is balance. It seems to me that with respect to creative entrepreneurs and writers and all that, that in fact it's their obsessiveness, it's the lack of balance, the fact that they're committed and almost wholly to the enterprise that they're you know, engaged in, and that they would sacrifice their social lives for that. That's what makes them successful. That in fact they don't have balance. What they have is a deep, an obsessive focus on the work that they are committed to.
But that then again, Sharad, whether it's entrepreneurs or very successful artists, I think that empirically has proven to be correct. You want to be super successful, you need to have a razor sharp focus.
So no balance.
No balance.
No balance, right?
No balance, yeah.
So
exactly.
Then the question is, okay, you know, tell us what you think about this idea of giving up a social life. Would you do so? You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We'll be tweeting out the article. You know, use that to reflect on your own lives. Tell us if you would give up your social life for something like writing a book.
But you see, Sharad, in my case, for example, having a balance is really, really important. I think just from your emotional, long-term emotional well-being, from a health perspective as well, having a balance is ultra critical for you in terms of longevity.
Okay, so do you want to live long but unsuccessful, or do you want to live a short, probably perhaps a slightly nasty life, but having great success because you've been single-minded about writing books and or developing
ads
or something like that? I mean, what's more important to you? Is it longevity and that kind of vague happiness, or the joys that come out of super success?
No, I think, Sharad, in my case, I want my cake and eat it.
You can't. So the English expression, you could have your cake and eat it, is an expression of impossibility, that you can't have. Nobody can have their cake and eat it. So that's the point. So is the trade-off worth it? Tell us, tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-889. We'll be back with more after this. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Walk This Way by Aerosmith and Run DMC. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Brian Fernandez. Time to talk about car accidents and those, you know, taking responsibility and how the law deals with them. I think traditionally, there was some leeway when you kill somebody during a car accident, you could face some sort of manslaughter charges. But now, in Britain, they're mulling the possibility of upping those charges to one that could get you a life sentence for murder involving an accident where you were callous, maybe you were looking at your phone and such. And, Brian, I wonder if, these attempts to deter bad driving behavior will actually work. Will people say, well, I'm likely to, face a life sentence and therefore I'm going to change, I'm going to be much more alert and less distracted on the road?
I think from a Malaysian context, I don't know. If there's a couple of high-profile cases that perhaps where the book is thrown at these drivers, then perhaps the deterrent value will sink in. But I'm really at two minds about this. On one hand, I see the value of stiffer sentences for errant driving. So people who are driving under the influence of alcohol, people who are driving under influence of hallucinogens or various sort of drugs, and they hit someone, that person passes away, then I think, yes, we should have stiff sentences, including charges for manslaughter. But then if it's cases on the other end of the spectrum, where you're a normal driver, somebody jumps in front of you, for example, let's just say, and I'm a cyclist, and this could happen, where, for example, a motorcyclist comes in front of you, and he's being really reckless. You knock that person dies, and you get charged for manslaughter. I think that's a little bit harsh.
So I guess you could have a system where the judges, of course, have discretion. They weigh the case. They look at the mitigating circumstances, and they come to some sort of conclusion. But in this story that we'll tweet out to you, the question of deterrence, I think, is central. And I wonder, because it is a policy tool. I'm always kind of, I'm not sure if it works, and I just think that we often don't think that we are going to be in that situation. This is why a deterrent sentence, and you're right, maybe you need a few high-profile cases to raise the kind of visibility or awareness.
Especially, Sharad, in a Malaysian context, because people, you can have all these laws, but until they are prosecuted and implemented, it will have no bearing on the psyche of individual, in this case, drivers.
Yeah, but the other thing, of course, is with the high-profile cases, that you look at it and you think it's a show, right? It's a spectacle. Something that's happening to somebody else. It's not something you'd necessarily associate your own life with. And this is the other problem, right? So, yes, the media can provide more visibility and raise the profile of legislation and the circumstances might lead any of us into those, especially when you talk about traffic, right? This is not drug, trafficking or and things like that, a murder. We're unlikely to see ourselves as potential murderers. But when it comes to, say, something like driving, yet people might see that as something other than themselves.
Yeah, but again, back to what I thought about, we spoke about earlier in terms of the deterrent value of it. It's hard to see, for myself, for example, I really see a possibility where, and this frightens me when you read about the sort of sentencing, perhaps I look down into the cockpit to get something and I knock someone down. That's a mistake on my part. It's very clear my fault. Now, should I then go to jail for 15 years because I looked down to pick up a coin or something that I had to?
Yeah, it does seem a bit harsh. And also,
absolutely.
And what does society benefit by taking somebody out who might have been a productive member of society, who just made a silly mistake and have them in jail? I mean, jail is a place that you put people to exclude them, to maybe take them out of other people's harm's way, right? So you take a serial killer out and put them away for the longest possible time because they are pathologically committed to killing people.
Yeah, so what you do, okay, in my case, I would be wrecked by guilt literally for the rest of my life if I'd caused harm or, worst case scenario, death of a fellow motorist or cyclist or whatever. But I think one value of then, you can't let the crime go unpunished. I think that's a very important philosophy. I still believe in that. I made a mistake. I should pay for it somewhat, in air quotes here in the studio. Perhaps one of
maybe
these,
compensation and maybe some community work.
Community work and compensation. My sentiments exactly.
Good Times by Jimmy Barnes and In Excess, taking us all the way up to the first bulletin of the day. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Ain't It a Sin, Charles Bradley. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Brian Fernandez. Time to talk about Dewan Bahasa and Pustaka. It's issued guidelines via Twitter on how to translate some common English slang words or expressions into the Malay language. Expressions like pick-up line and photobomb and kilfi and nap even. For the uninitiated, kilfi is a selfie taken at a dangerous location which may possibly cause death. For the translation of photobomb, Dewan Bahasa and Pustaka suggested tuna photo. Now, you might think this has got to do with that large fish that comes in small cans in brine or in oil. But no, it's not, because tuna in Malay also means injured, flawed, or broken. So tuna photo suggests, you know, a damaged photograph now, or photographic moment rather. Will these translations into Malay of popular English slang words and expressions have an impact on the language actually used by young people? For some insights, we spoke to Chegu Anuradha Chalaya, poet and primary school teacher. We asked her what she thought about the new words introduced by Dewan Bahasa.
I think Dewan Bahasa is doing a good move by introducing the new words. But then I don't know how far the words are going to be reaching the grassroots level, especially students in schools, because students are very fond of using words that they commonly hear or commonly being used by their parents or family members. So I don't know. I'm not sure how effective the words are going to be.
We also asked if her students actually use these words in their, say, their essays or in their social interactions.
Yeah. Selfie is very commonly used. I'm sure that Dewan Bahasa has come out with a different word, you know, swa photo in BM. I find students hardly use the new words that are being introduced by Dewan Bahasa, even in their daily communication with other teachers or with me. Sometimes when they speak to me in Bahasa Malaysia, the word that comes often to them is the commonly used words. That means selfie, they hardly use the newly introduced words.
That was a poet and primary school teacher, Anuradha Chalaya, speaking about Dewan Bahasa and Pustaka's initiative to give a Malay translation to popular words and expressions in the English language.
So, Sharad, I'm a little bit confused here. So, let's look at, say, how the Oxford English Dictionary incorporates new words. So, the methodology there is often something that's colloquial. It's used often enough. They take it, they incorporate it into the, give it a definition, incorporate it into the dictionary, they give it a definition, and then, and that's their methodology. Here, what the Dewan Bahasa is trying to do is take a commonly used word, give it a different spin, and then define it. Now, how is that going to actually be adopted by people? I'm skeptical.
Yeah, you know, it requires, of course, these words to be given some sort of visibility. But it might direct, say, for instance, national broadcasters that are maybe more attentive to what the Dewan Bahasa and Pustaka do to use these, right? So until now, say, for instance, if you were a news reporter in the Malay language and you wanted to use the word selfie, right, that comes out of these new technologies and the new uses of technologies, you would just say selfie because that would be the word to use. And there would be no adequate translation of it. So what Dewan Bahasa and Pustaka is saying, well, actually, now we have one and you can use it. Now, if your national broadcasters use it regularly enough, perhaps it will catch on. And maybe, or some popular, you know, artist or figure in you know, in culture does so as well, it could catch on. But until now, what people have had to do is rely on the word that it's become popular. So if you look at the way in which English words are incorporated into the Japanese language, right? So see, if technology is driving some of our new words, or generating new words, then, you know, it will come from those countries, right?
Yeah, but it's not just an English language or Bahasa. And you're right, it's unique to any language. It's not unique to any language that's evolving. You take and pick from different languages and stuff, especially things like technology.
So let's say Hindi. Hindi speakers in India, how would they deal with a huge number of words that are coming out of more technologically advanced countries that are producing words in order to describe the things that have become commonplace through the use of new technologies? And so, you know, I'd be interested to see how, say, those in India kind of deal with, who are Hindi speakers, deal with that. You know, but you know what, Dewan Bahasa and Pustaka, I think his responsibility is more than just reflecting what's going on. I think their responsibility is also helping the development of the language. So, and I think in this regard, that's exactly what their role is. How successful they'll be, I don't know, because if you listen to people speak Bahasa Malaysia, it's very mixed. And you know, politicians speak, you know, English and Malay almost simultaneously, and you have the use of all kinds of words that have popularly known, but that don't sound particularly Malay.
But here's the thing. Then as the language evolves, after they've defined this, it then gets defined into... So first it goes into the dictionary, Malay dictionary. Second step then, because it's Dewan Bahasa, it goes into the textbooks. So I suppose that's when the evolution and the adoption of these words will take a fair degree of time. Because as they are incorporated into the textbooks, young people then start using them.
Fascinating. Tell us what you think. Tweet us at BFM Radio. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Tell us if your kids are using the term tuna foto. Tell us. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Rocksteady by Bad Company. I'm Sharad. And with me, Brian, because we're good company for you in the morning. It's just 50 minutes past 6 on the 16th of October.
Yeah, so yesterday, Sharad, there were two articles in the Sunday Star which really discussed the issue of volunteerism in Malaysia. And sadly, the numbers are quite small. So the Women's Family and Community Development Ministry said that only 1% of people aged above 15 are registered as volunteers. And according to a 2010 survey, there are only about 7 registered volunteers per 1,000 Malaysians. So that's overall 135 full-fledged volunteers in Malaysia, less than 1% of youth, as I mentioned earlier. So does that really indicate that Malaysians are not really, or Malaysian youth in particular, are not really interested in doing volunteer work?
Well, yeah, I think that's a clear indication. And also perhaps they're not being encouraged. Though, and we have also from the story, Kachara Soup Kitchen Project Director Justin Chia saying that Malaysians are kind people. They're eager to donate cash and items to disaster victims. But donating time and effort is a different story. And so the question is, how do we see this, right? And I'm thinking of parents in particular as role models for children. To what extent they say, okay, you have your tuition classes, you have your piano to go for, guitar classes, all these things they're quite willing to push their children into, or encourage their children into. But volunteer work, I'm not so sure, because I'm not sure. You know, tell us if you think that you would encourage your children to volunteer. You can tweet us at BFM Radio, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Tell us, you know, is this something you think it's good for your children in terms of, you know, how it changes them as people?
Yeah, because volunteerism, I think, helps to mold young individuals. I mean, everybody in general. I mean,
it teaches you empathy.
Empathy. Especially with children of privilege. So if you go, for example, you're from a middle class or upper middle class or upper class background, a lot of time there's no empathy with the daily struggles of, say, for example, the B40s. So by doing volunteer work, I think that instills a sense of empathy, as you correctly pointed out, from a very young age. And that then can translate, I think, to a much more well-balanced personality as they get older?
Well, you know, I'm proof that that might not happen. I did, in fact, do volunteer work as a young person, but mostly when I was at university, and I worked with, you know, a project for children of the working class in Singapore in a place called Jalan Kayu. And I spent many years there with young kids whose life circumstances and opportunities are very different than I had had growing up. And so it did teach me to kind of put myself in their shoes. But I wonder, actually, to what extent, because I don't see that in my family necessarily. I don't see the kids in my family being encouraged or, in fact, doing volunteer work. They're very involved in a lot of extracurricular activities and sports or, you know, in their religious associations. Stuff, but voluntary work, whether it's for poor people or for the environment, I don't see much of that.
I think that this should be a government initiative to really try to, from a top-down approach, really encourage not only just children but society as a whole to really do a lot more volunteer work.
This is precisely where governments should stay away. And this is where, you know, a call for government is kind of wrong-headed. It's precisely something that must come out of people to be sustained. If, you know, government jumps in every time the, you know, society fails to kind of think about itself, I think we're kind of, you know, it's a crutch. I mean, government is a crutch in this instance.
No, I disagree with you, Sharad, because here's the thing. You want to start a movement or an equation on a national level. You want a more caring society. What do? You start to educate. You have some campaigns.
Yeah, and that can happen from the ground up. It doesn't need government.
But it takes time to
percolate. Government is in the business of, you know, creating agencies and staffing people to do precisely social work. Voluntarism is something that must come from the local. It must come from the ground. Otherwise, it's not voluntarism. Then you might as well just set up something and, you know, make sure that people are obliged to do that kind of work. Then it's not voluntarism.
No, but I'm not advocating setting up a new department in the Prime Minister's department. I mean, that's not the case. It's really about the relevant ministry, say Ministry of Welfare and so forth, running a campaign saying, hey guys, it's a good thing. Let's all get involved in volunteer work. And I think that's going to have some impact.
It's a contradiction in terms, right? Government telling us to volunteer. Well, tell us what you think. Tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tell us if you volunteer and why you do. Coming up before we hit 7 o'clock and the next bulletin, When I Come Around by Green Day. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez, and the morning run continues. It's just a little after 6 minutes past seven on the 16th of October, because it's a Monday and we have an exciting week, not only because it's being punctuated by Deepavali celebrations and a public holiday, right smack in the middle. So sweet sounds of a public holiday coming up your way. Also a time to renew ties and foster understanding about different communities in the country. Now, last week, Minister for Human Resources, Dr. Richard Riot, said that a new minimum wage rate will be announced next year. He said the move will close the gap in the private sector. Currently, the minimum wage rate is 1,000 ringgit in the peninsula and 920 ringgit in Sabah, Sarawak and the Federal Territory of Labuan. We spoke to Ali Salman, Director of Research at the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, or IDEAS. We asked him what he thought the minimum wage rate will be next year, whether the rate will be sufficient in light of current socioeconomic conditions.
Yeah, thank you. I'll take a step back and I will question the rationale of having the minimum wage. According to government-owned statistics, about 1% of the labor actually is earning minimum or less than minimum wage. And the vast majority is already earning more than the minimum wage. Therefore, I would like to have this opinion that minimum wage, when enforced strictly, may not be the best possible welfare tool for the labor themselves. Because when you keep increasing the minimum wage, you don't only increase the cost of the doing business, but you also give a signal to the market, particularly the employers, to move to the illegal or informal labor market, which is a big problem in Malaysia already. Therefore, it is important to understand that the discussions around the minimum wage must be led by, you know, sound economic policies, and to understand that the labor or minimum wage is essentially is a result of a contract between the employer and the employee. And excessive government intervention in setting up a minimum wage or increasing the minimum wage may not be the best thing for the economy.
Now, the Human Resource Ministry also said it hopes to minimize the income gap between the peninsula and East Malaysia. We asked Ali to explain why this gap exists in the first place.
There are different factors which would derive and determine the cost of living. I understand that living in peninsula would be actually more expensive, relatively speaking, to the other parts of the country. And therefore, I would not recommend to artificially close down these gaps. Some of these gaps are dictated by the market forces. And while the government must take necessary measures for safeguard the interest of the labor by provisioning of social standards, such as education, health, I think enforcement of an equal wage across sectors, across different areas, is not a sound economic policy.
Well, there's also an argument that there should be different minimum wage rates across different industries as opposed to a blanket minimum wage. We asked Ali if there's any value in this argument.
Each industry has a unique set of circumstances. An automobile industry cannot be compared with the plantation, for instance. And therefore, while it is true that each of these sectors have different kind of circumstances, I imagine that the cost of the labor would be different. So on that note, I, in principle, understand that the wage rates can be different across the sectors. But again, I'm not saying that there should be a government role in determining what should be the minimum wage across sectors.
That was Ali Salman, Director of Research at the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, or IDEAS, weighing in on the announcement by the Minister of Labour that we will have a new minimum wage early next year.
Yeah, so the thing is, Sharad, I mean, in principle, I'm all for increasing minimum wage. I think we need to have the right sort of mechanism to increase minimum wage on an annualized basis, not just reviewed every few years. Because cost of living are going up, and especially at the bottom end of society, the costs are rising at a faster rate than their wages are.
Yeah. I think the other side of the coin in this is in terms of, you know, the stakeholders is the question of unionized labor and the trade union system and whether our trade unions represent enough of the labor force, that represent stakeholders with enough leverage to weigh in on this discussion. Because till now, you hear government speak about minimum wage. You've heard, employers speak about within some think tanks like IDEAS jump in order to push the free market ideologies with regard to wages. But we don't really hear from the trade unions. The trade unions have long ceased to be a serious contender in setting government policy, at least what is visible to the public. And so for me, you know, that is a real lack, a real gap in the way in which wages are discussed and, in fact, are moved in this country.
No, that, Sharad, I agree with you. And Ali Salman brought up a very interesting point of also then defining minimum wage according to industry. So that traditionally is a role that's done by industry-specific trade unions. So you've got a very good point there. Now, within some industries, let's look example as banking. So the banking, banking has a, I think, National Union of Bank Employees, and that's a very, very powerful union, and strictly, you know, I think the banks are very, very careful whenever they deal with employee relations because the unions are very strong.
Yeah, the NUBE.
NUBE. On the flip side of the equation, especially with lower end, say, manufacturing jobs and so forth, especially at an SME level, there's virtually no labor, worker protection and so forth. So Ali Salman talks about how the challenge is if you raise minimum wages too quickly, basically they would be substituted with illegal workers. Now, the way to get around that is really about then enforcing our laws against them hiring illegal workers.
Yeah, and you know that, I think in the last 2 years we've had quite a bit of news flow on the question of undocumented workers and who's responsible and crack down on it and such and I think attempts to regularize those workers and such. But the magnitude is such, I think, that it's a nearly impossible task, right? The leakages, that come through the lack of enforcement or corruption within the system and the enforcement agencies has meant that we have literally millions of people now, and that is the system. Now, trying to overhaul that, having, as it were, let the situation run riot for years, for decades now, I think it's a really tricky one.
I think that's the big issue, really, because there's so many vested interests that are actually benefiting from this whole scenario of illegal workers. It's going to be hard to overhaul the system. And I've always thought about, and this is a personal opinion, that the first thing we should be doing is legalizing the workers who are already here rather than bringing in more people.
Absolutely. Long discussion, this one. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.